Mr. Lambert, how old are you?
You mean in human years?
Yes.
I don't really believe in keeping track of that kind of thing, Hubie. You know, age is just a state of mind.
That's why I played T-ball till I was 25. Hello, boys and ghouls, and welcome to an episode of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm your ghost with the most, Devon Decker, and joining me, my ghost companion, Sejan Serowik. Hello, Sejan.
Hello.
We're here today to cultivate for you a guide to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. So strap in for tricks and treats! All right, I can't do that anymore.
It's our Halloween in July episode, folks.
It's
You know
June.
that
That's the
you know
best
that
part.
oh yeah, that's right.
June's going as July this Halloween.
But you know that famous thing that all podcasts eventually do, the midsummer Halloween.
I actually think they call it Funkoween, because I've been getting so many emails. You buy one Funko Pop figure, and suddenly you're on a list. And they do a Halloween in the summer thing called Funkoween, and thanks, you're welcome for the free advertising, Funko, I suppose. It's not.
Do they do a Hubie Funko Pop? Because I will buy one this instant.
I don't know. I'm looking at my Happy Gilmore Funko Pop, so it's not outside the realm of possibility. But I, as far as I know, they haven't done one yet. But hi, welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. We have reached the finale of our first season, exploring the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. We started with all of the movies featuring double V named female leads.
It wasn't just that.
It was
You're gonna give a
that for me.
real false impression that that was the only reason these movies were chosen.
Well, I mean, we had to start with Billy Madison, and then the most tenuous connection that existed was the double V names.
We thought,
Yes.
but we have discovered over the course of the last season that there was actually more to this. No, that's not even true. So, like, no, this is a good time for us to do this, though, right? A quick reflection on exactly not just what we're doing, but why we're doing it, right? So we are exploring a connected universe that is found throughout the Sandler films. And when Hubie Halloween, the movie that we are going to be discussing today, came out in October, like, this was kind of the thing that kind of set off some fireworks. Now, we pointed out even then, well, this isn't the first time that we have noticed connections between these films, but something about this particular movie set off the idea in so many people's hearts that, I mean, even in ours, we felt the need to do a whole show that needed to be dedicated to exploring it, right? So there is something about this film, and there is something about Billy Madison, there is something about Happy Gilmore, there is something about The Waterboy, and there is something about Little Nicky that really, and Pixels, that is the other one, cannot forget last month's episode, Pixels, that we felt really tied together a concept of a connected universe where all of these characters could run into one another and it would not be out of too weird of a realm, right? Like it would make sense. And so what was it? And yes, there were some obvious things that we pointed to when we first designed this, right? Like the double V names definitely was something that drew us to these films. But for me, I will say, maybe for you, that's all it took. But for me, I needed some more solid threads. And there were some specific things that had to be going on. I mean, first and foremost, we had to be focusing on Sandler-led like films. It is hard to ignore the ensemble that has grown around him in a sense, you know, the early days of this podcast and since the early days of his career. But like, there needed to be a focus on him. So it's the reason why we didn't do something like Grown Ups, right? Or you know, or any of his like romantic comedies or anything yet. And we'll get to those, but they are these are much more geared specifically towards him. You know, on top of that, there had to be some other rules, some that we would discover along the way, but some that we had when we first laid out. We should actually go over some of the rules that we've kind of created up to this point, I think. I think this is a good time to do that, Dan.
I think that is a beautiful way to kick off this episode. I wish that I had been smart enough to have that page, and I did, but then it moved away from me.
Yeah.
Because
I'm all in one too, so let me pull mine up.
Excellent. So the laws of the ASCU, as they currently stand, before mm-hmm. we talk about Hubie Halloween, I have Eric Gordon is the worst villain.
Mm-hmm. Which I think still stands true. I think we'll talk more about it, but I stand behind that one. Yep, I think that has proven true.
The central plot of these films see an Adam Sandler portrayed character bringing a villain to his level, mm-hmm. which is an interesting thing and something I'm ready to dispute with Hubie Halloween. Which I'm excited to dispute, right? Because that's the mm-hmm. thing about this is, much like a code of conduct and a code of honor, this is a living thing and it's going to be malleable and it's going to change. And part of this whole journey is tracking that change. So, you know, but bringing the villain to his level, that is a pretty central conceit of an Adam Sandler film.
Mm-hmm.
There is the importance of a female lead who doesn't need his character.
Yeah, the idea being that, and what that means specifically is that there's not really moments where that character is in a position to require Sandler's help to set her on the right path. And like, at no point do we see the female lead in these films ever, their life is not in shambles until Adam Sandler saves them from whatever distress that they're currently in. They could go about their lives without him. They choose not to, though, is the important part of the romantic storylines in these. Yeah.
Yes. They like him, but their lives, they'd be on the same trajectory. Sort of like Raiders of the Lost Ark, not needing Indiana Jones to happen.
Exactly.
Family is key. It's a wholehearted approach to be a film in the ASCU.
Mm-hmm.
I can't make out my writing here. I think I wrote sports as everyman. Does that?
I don't know. I don't know, because that definitely applies to some of them, I guess.
Starts but as everyman. He starts as everyman. That actually yes. makes more sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. I was about to say, what we can do today is we can point to all of his characters definitely being like the everyman character of their particular cohort. Right. Like if you pointed to, because like I'm thinking of something like Little Nicky, where that comes a little bit harder to talk about as he is literally the son of Satan. But if you look at him in the context of his family, he is definitely the normal one, right? Like he is the one that is not evil. He is the one that is just out there to kind of have fun and do his thing and is just caught up in a world, right? And that's true of all of his characters. They are every man caught up in a situation.
Which, that's just fun for me, as someone who had to read Everyman at least 6 times to get my degree. The next one is sort of an addendum to family is key, and that is family doesn't just need to be blood, it extends yes. to friends.
Mm-hmm. That is actually, I think, hugely important when you look at things like Pixels and Little Nicky and Hubie and stuff. Go ahead.
You look at Sandler's characters are generally aware enough to understand shame. He doesn't play any shameless characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not so stupid that he doesn't comprehend what's going on in the moment. So I think early on, what I said is he's not like Steve Martin in The Jerk, right? Where like, he's not dense.
Sorry. Sandler is willing to go low to make that money, despite Seija not liking it.
I say it's not a rule that I love, but it is one that holds true. Yep.
It no longer needs a face of evil. I'm not sure. That sounds like something you would have said. That sounds like
Well, so I think what that was that we very early wanted to kind of focus on specific villains. And I think this is really interesting because of the way that it alters, doesn't negate, and I'm going to, and we can have this discussion, alters that earlier comment that I made where he takes kind of the people that we see as his antagonists and brings them down to his level. And I think that what it became is that idea that not all of the Sandlerverse movies require a main antagonist that is like that is the focus. So like we're talking about our Erics or we're talking about our Shooter McGaverns. Those characters don't have to exist.
We have magic is real, mm-hmm. as are heaven and hell,
mm-hmm.
which that I can't wait to apply that particular law to Hubie Halloween. Little Nicky is the linchpin.
Yep. Yeah. we discovered watching that film and to be fair, it was something that you said you brought to the table very early on, but the idea that Little Nicky was going to be the kind of the thing that really was going to allow so many other things into this universe. And I agree with that to this day. Hubie Halloween would not fit into the rest of this if it was not for something like Little Nicky coming first. And Pixels.
Yeah. Which, from Pixels, we have determined that aliens exist in the ASCU. Mm-hmm. And perhaps the biggest tenet currently in our laws of the ASCU is that nostalgia is a huge part of the films of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yes. I stand by every single one of those. Every single one of those, Devin. Even the ones you want to talk a little bit about. I'm so happy that that's what we've got so far. So that's what we've established as kind of the main rules so far. And we are going to go into maybe one or two more tonight. And then those are going to be kind of what was important about establishing these rules in terms of doing this podcast was that it was then going to allow us to possibly start looking outside of like the obvious ones, these six being the quote unquote obvious ones, and start wondering, you know, like what else fits in. The reason that became part of the discussion, just as a reminder to everybody, is that at the same time that Hubie Halloween was in everybody's eyeline, it was the word I was looking for, eyesight, is because at the same time, Uncut Gems was in the water and people were talking about things like Oscar nominations and things like that, and whether or not Sandler had maybe developed into a more dramatic actor, and maybe that's where his focus should stay. And like, does Uncut Gems fit with some of these other ones? And there were moments throughout the recording of this podcast where I felt a little like I was on shaky ground saying no. Tonight is no different. I still kind of have to say no, but I'm not going to say that Devin could not sway me one way or the other.
I hate that I'd be the one who'd have to sway it, but it's super true.
You are the voice in my head every Wednesday, but yeah.
I went back and I listened to the episode that launched this project. We do another podcast besides the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe called The Say Report. And October of 2020, I believe it was October 16th that we released it, we did an episode called The Hubie Report. And that is where we started to like jokingly explore what it would mean to be an Adam Sandler cinematic universe, because it was the cultural consciousness at the time. Everybody was discussing it. And in addition, people were coming to both of us independently saying, where do you two weigh in on this?
Yeah.
And you know, a lovely joke about Hollywood having contacted us to be the ones to cultivate that.
I mean, this very weekend, sitting at a cookout, like explaining that we were coming to the end on this, and somebody being like, somebody basically saying, like, good, like, I needed somebody in my life to do this, and I needed it to be you. And I was like, thanks. I think I'll take that as a compliment.
Meanwhile, on my side of the world, I was doing goofy voices, I'll say about a week ago, and my father, like, to my mother, in that whisper speak, like a stage whisper, goes, your son does know he's not Adam Sandler, right?
Oh, no. We have gotten too deep, Devin.
To which like, I'm like, I don't really think of myself as Adam Sandler. I'm not Pete Davidson saying, I hope my trajectory follows that of Adam Sandler after SNL. I still can't get over that. I can't get over everybody would like their career trajectory to follow that of Adam Sandler. I don't want to make it a law of the ASCU right now, but like it's one of the three, like It's a Newtonian law at this point. Who wouldn't want?
I don't want to. I'm not going to turn this Adam Sandler podcast into a shit on Pete Davidson podcast. Not least of which because I don't hate the guy. I think that he is very funny. He is the kind of guy to say something and look at the camera as if he said something controversial, but what he just said will be the most like dull comment ever made. I cannot tell you how many times I have seen bits from him and comments from him and tweets and shit from him that are just large. He's just like, "Ooh, I'm a real stinker," and you're just like, "No," like everyone in the room agrees with you. That's not brave. You don't get to stand up on stage, say something everybody agrees with, and then act like you're the asshole in the room. Like that doesn't work.
I'd like to remind the listener that Seijin didn't want to turn this into a shitting on Pete Davidson podcast.
I'm done.
But it's one of those situations where this is a thing that kind of needed to be done. And if nobody else was going to step into what I have learned over these past 6 months cultivating an Adam Sandler cinematic universe is it's not easy. And I'm not saying I don't want an award for like doing it's like I thought, oh, we're going to look at Adam Sandler movies and then it's going to be fun. And no, there's some real like
there was
stuff
work to be done on this.
I've had to wade through like personal feelings.
But to that point, right, is we have been very open every part of the step of this show that the way that people, to our understanding, the way that people outside of our little universe look at this is this was diving into the dregs. This was stepping into the proverbial like Hollywood sewer. Pardon me. I can't even say it. It doesn't feel right in my throat, but it is the way that people view this stuff, right? That like that idea that we were going to dive into these movies and we weren't going to talk about things like Punch Drunk Love. We weren't going to talk about Uncut Gems yet. We weren't going to dive into what some people consider to be the better work, right? We were going to look for the ones that became controversial, not because he's saying things that we didn't agree with, but controversial because people just turned off to it, right? Like they just didn't have a desire to see some of these movies. And that goes all the way back to Happy Gilmore and Billy Madison. Like his earliest works were ones that got lambasted by certain groups. And so the idea that we were going to be the ones to dive into the shit was definitely something that a lot of people that would view this as, right? And the thing was, the reason why it had to be us is because we didn't see it that way. Like the shit didn't stink to us, right? And I am happy to say that coming out of the other side of this, actually dedicating time and work to this, not just watching movies for fun, but legitimately taking notes and pulling things apart and getting overly analytical, way too overly analytical with these movies, like I still have enjoyed myself every step of the way. Even times when I wasn't enjoying myself with these movies, and there were moments, if you go back and listen to things like Little Nicky and When the Water Boy, like I mentioned moments that I was not enjoying myself necessarily in the moment. Sitting here, recording this with you, getting this stuff out there, and then talking to people subsequently about what we have talked about has been a blast.
Yeah, and those feelings of not really being there, I've had mine too. It's not just Seijin who realized, oh, there's going to be some bad with the good of Adam Sandler. Bad mm-hmm. with the good that is the bad of Adam Sandler. My whole view on something like Happy Gilmore has shifted. And Hubie Halloween, I mean, we're going to get deeper into it, but this was a challenge for me. Watching this film was a real challenge for me.
Yeah, well, I definitely want to talk about that then, because I'll be like, let's do it. First impressions right now. Like, I enjoyed this movie even more the second time around. So I sat here, had a fucking giggle fit all day while I watched this movie, had to then rewatch it because I forgot to take notes the first time. I was having so much fun. So like, let's do it. Let's talk about this movie.
Yeah. So I think my big issue is I need to start doing with the Adam Sandler films what I did with Pixels. And that is, I have to do a viewing that does not include a notebook in my hand. I need to just familiarize myself with these films again. And something like Hubie Halloween, even if I had been doing that from the start with this show, I don't think I would have done that because I felt like it was so fresh in my mind, having watched it October of last year.
Exactly.
But sitting down and watching it again, I suddenly understood how all those critics felt in 2000 when they watched Little Nicky, and the headline and tagline of every review was, "This is a greatest hits of Adam Sandler."
Yes. Yeah. And we even noted that there's definitely ways that that movie feels like that. I think the difference between this and Little Nicky, I would put out there, is that Little Nicky wasn't necessarily meant to be that. It feels like it just kind of became that because that was just the work that they did. This feels like that's what they were aiming for. Like, this felt like it was kind of like a clip show wrapped up in a fun story.
Exactly. And having just come from watching the primary films that are being referenced in Hubie Halloween, and especially when we consider that nostalgia is that major driving force behind an ASCU film, all I found myself wishing is that I was watching Billy Madison or The Waterboy or Little Nicky and not Hubie Halloween.
Like, I'm going to go super meta for just a quick second about this. So the namesake of this podcast, the ASCU, the MCU, I find it really interesting that your feelings on Hubie are that, because I feel like this mirrors a lot of my and your initial feelings on Endgame and the ways in which that, if watched, like, it can feel like it's just a highlight reel of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and not a good enough movie in its own right. And I can definitely understand those criticisms. And there was a lot of that feeling and talk between you and me and Dale and Zach of just like, yeah, it feels kind of hollow in these moments. And there's a lot of fan service in it, like undeniable, a ton of fan service in that movie. And Hubie feels a lot like that. And it is the end game, it feels like, of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, where like let's go back to the heroes, let's see what they've been up to, let's figure out like what they're like now 20 years later, and then like let's make jokes about it and not be serious about this thing that for some people was like actually like super important and informative. And so like it falls into a lot of the same, it can fall into a lot of the same pitfalls that something like that does, right? And I think that that's the price of like all of this buildup, is I don't know if there would have been a way to pay off in a way that would have both done the let's revisit everything we want to revisit while at the same time be something so brand spanking new that it feels like it's its own thing. I don't know if there's a way to balance those two feelings. And I just find it really interesting that I feel like we had this exact same conversation about Endgame and about the ways in which it addressed a lot of early stuff in the MCU and how it felt like, because it was so busy looking backwards, it never became a movie itself.
Yeah, it and speaking on that, I think that's why something like Hubie Halloween, when it first dropped, inspired all of that conversation about an interconnected universe between all of Sandler's films. Because of that weird subconscious connection you have between something like Hubie Halloween and Endgame that came out a year earlier.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I think it's because the goals are extremely similar. The idea being like, look, people have been, this is literally one for the fans. This is for the people that have been with us every step of the way. And this is just going to be 100 minutes of film time for them to just sit back and enjoy themselves. And I think they do a really smart thing with Hubie Halloween in tying it into a holiday film, because as we have discussed many times on the Say Report, and now I get to talk about this here, that idea that something about holiday films allows us to throw all concepts of good filmmaking out the window. And I'm not saying that because holiday movies don't have to be good. It's that holiday movies kind of, for me, end up getting judged on a whole different scale, right? And so that might also be part of what's going on here and why I'm able to enjoy myself so much with this, and you're finding yourself, when you analyze it, having a hard time, is because there is a built-in bias for me that I'm going to have to admit here up front. But I think that they were so aware of that kind of bias, because another holiday film that we have not yet talked about is 8 Crazy Nights that Sandler and Ed does. And a lot of this same shit can be levied against that. And I think that there is something to be said that in Sandler's attempt to make a film for his fans, make a film that's for the holidays, it definitely can feel thin in a lot of ways. There's moments where shit just happens and you just have to believe like plot holes just are going to occur, but it's okay because it's holiday magic. And as we know, because one of our rules is out there, magic exists in this universe, so that's okay. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like there's also that whole element to it as well. Just more things to throw into the pot here that are making this movie, that are working against this film if you look too closely.
Watching this film from an analytical standpoint, specifically, how does this relate to other Adam Sandler films? Like, that's all my notes are. My notes are, oh, Dodgeball from Billy Madison. Oh, O'Doyle's from Billy Madison. Oh, a deep cut reference to Happy Gilmore. Like, and it's fine, but it was, the first time I watched this film, I could admit that it was a little thin, but it was fun for what it was trying to be, which was an Adam Sandler Halloween movie. But then coming to it with this as the goal and the intention, it was difficult. I'm not going to lie. And I don't know. I mean, that's just it. Especially when the weirdest connective tissue I have is Steve Brill directed three of these films that we did throughout this. Happy Gilmore, and then he's a big driving force behind Little Nicky, and now this. And right. Happy Gilmore, Little Nicky, and this really do feel like a trilogy in terms of the callbacks and the characters who exist within them. I mean, Chubb showing up in Little Nicky, and then Hal showing up in Hubie Halloween. There is the tightest connection between these three films.
Yeah, if we really wanted to pare down this podcast, like, we could have done three episodes of just these three films and really, like, they could have just, it could have been, like, a mini-series on the Sayre Report, right? For sure. But Hubie also reaches out to so many other Sandler things that we couldn't ignore.
Oh, exactly. And I'm glad that we're going for, what we've done what we've done, and that we have plans to go forward deeper into the Sandlerverse after we finish this season and figure out the next rich vein to mine. But it was just very, and I think the strangest thing about that is when it comes to trilogies, this is my personal opinion, generally the middle part is my favorite part.
Mm-hmm.
And as established, you can go back and listen to it. Watching Little Nicky 20 years later as an adult, that film spoke to so much of my own personal beliefs.
Yeah.
And I really wonder how much of my ideas and ideals related to religion came from me watching Little Nicky at 15.
Yeah.
And I know that's a scary thing to say, but it's just a true statement that I'm willing to own up to.
I mean, movies affect us. Ta-da! Like, that's not a new thing for us to say at all, especially at the young, ripe age of teenage, right? Like they form and shape us in ways that we don't understand at the time. Anybody that tells you otherwise is an idiot. No, man. I feel like that's true for sure. I think we got to get. I think we got to get into some synopsis here.
Yeah. So I mean, because this is a Netflix film, though, usually we explore facts and figures. Do you have anything on this? Do we know how this one, like, aired out?
So the,
or
so. We got a double whammy this week, folks. Not only am I fucked because of the way that as expressed in the other universe, but for anybody that does not was not there for that tirade, let me reiterate it here in our universe. There have been some changes to Box Office Mojo and the way that IMDb runs their things that I am not privy to a lot of information. I love you all. I don't know if I love you all so much to sign up for IMDb Pro. So with like losing that, and then on top of that, and we can talk a little bit more about this now if you'd like to. This is our first foray into the Sandler Netflix deals. Because it was soon after Pixels, the last one that we did, that he signed a 6-picture deal with Netflix. Although I think at this point it's gone well beyond that, to basically just have free reign to just make the kinds of movies he wants to make in whatever fashion he makes. And this is the first time that we've kind of gotten to see that here. Definitely not the first one, though. I think this is probably number 6, actually,
this,
I think, out
this
of all
one
of them,
finished that original deal,
yeah,
which is why we talk about you mentioning that this is sort of like the end game of the Adam Sandler films.
Yeah.
In a way, if this didn't score and if the other stuff didn't score, this might have been the end of Adam Sandler on Netflix.
Yeah. Well, what I can point to, though, is that within a month after this, the release of this film, Variety, I mean, as well as many other ones, but Variety being the most notable trade to talk about films, was already talking about Hubie Halloween 2 being in the works at Netflix. And there were straight up petitions. There were numerous petitions online from Sandler fans asking for a Hubie Halloween 2. Well, I think coming off of the idea that they knew that this was the last possible thing that was coming from Netflix with him at the time. Since then, we have not quite heard whether or not there's going to be a Hubie Halloween 2, but I think at this point it'd be silly for them to not be considering it. But we know that there is an animated project on the way. We know that there's a couple of other live action projects on the way as well. There's some television shows that have been in the works as far as Happy Madison Productions with them. So, like, they're not done. Netflix and Sandler have grown to love each other too much. And, I mean, part of that is because every time a Sandler movie comes out, including Hubie Halloween, ever since they introduced the top 10 lists on Netflix, Sandler has sat pretty in that top 10 list for weeks after coming out. Hubie sat at number one for days, even after Halloween, which for a holiday movie is something to be said. Like, this, usually what you get is you get the Christmas movie, you know, Santa Claus and all that shit, and it's good until at least that weekend, and then after that it's dead in the water. But that was not the case with Hubie, and so I don't have solid numbers. I wish I did for stuff like this, but in addition to Netflix keeping mum about everything, us not having anything like Box Office Mojo to look to, so all I've got to go on is just, like, fan reaction. And by all accounts, this was one of the favorites. You know, the only other one that I think might have done better because of just the amount of praise it got, not just from fans but also from critics, is Murder Mystery, the one he did with his return to working with Jennifer Aniston for Netflix. Anybody that hasn't seen it, by the way, it's a phenomenal little romantic comedy action film. Like, it's actually a hell of a good time. It's also one of those movies I love, the vacation film, where clearly, like, the two leads just wanted to go be in Europe for 2 months, so they decide to make a movie together. The best example of that is Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp in The Tourist, where they're in Venice for the majority of that film and openly admitted that they didn't care about the movie, they just wanted to go to Venice together.
You know who might be fun to hang out with in Venice? Johnny Depp. I was wrong, but...
Yeah. I don't have solid numbers for you. I wish I did. But by all accounts, this is one of the ones that was for the books. Now, that being said, the only solid numbers that I really have to look to are things like Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes, but take those sites with a grain of salt, because they tell you that it has a 50% rating from critics, but then 8 out of the 10 ratings from critics are all fresh. So it just happens to be that they weight the other two more than the first 8. So they balance out in a weird way. That whole system is screwed. So someday somebody's going to write a really good documentary about how the rating system went down the tubes when the internet got involved.
Are you declaring something here, Seijin, or?
No. Metacritic alone, right? And the amount of times that we have heard about, like astroturfing campaigns and things like that, and like the idea that you could go to the internet to get solid ratings on a thing was something that I believed in when I was much younger. But I am an older man now and much wiser.
Yeah. It is interesting, but that's good. I mean, I wasn't expecting any facts and figures, to be honest with you, because of how mum all streaming seems to be with their numbers. But it is, and that the follow-up that you did provide, that there was that call for Hubie Halloween 2, and then I'll also introduce that I know that as a result of this, there was heavy talk online about doing a sequel, like a direct sequel to Billy Madison or Happy Gilmore. So it's not completely off base.
Yeah.
So now I think we're going to get to the synopsis. I think it's synopsis time. Let me take a sip of water and make sure I don't slip into Hubie voice. We join our story on the eve of Halloween in Salem, Massachusetts, a city with a witch history. Our hero is the 54-year-old Hubie Schubert Dubois, who, despite being kind, generous, and overall selfless individual, is treated like the town idiot and constantly belittled and bullied by the residents, whether it be in the form of malicious pranks or the near-constant barrage of items being thrown at him. Sweet Hubie is generally able to rise above their insultation, but Halloween can make things difficult, as his fatal flaw is a proclivity for being frightened. The only Salem Salemite, besides his mother, that seems to appreciate our protagonist as a worthwhile individual is Violet Valentine, awarded the superlatives of most friendly, most popular, and best looking, the high school hat trick, and despite having married and divorced law enforcement officer Steve Downey, can't help but look at him with the same stars in her eyes she had when they were in first grade. Each year, in spite of his fear, and this October 31st, God deciding to go with a full moon, Hubie still gears up with his self-made Swiss Army thermos to fulfill the duties of his annual self-appointed role as official volunteer Halloween helper, teaching the children about door-to-door candy etiquette and acting as a safety monitor during the Halloween festivities to help ensure that every citizen and tourist in Salem has a safe and happy Halloween. What Hubie doesn't know is that in addition to the everyday mischief that both children and adults are prone to get into on All Hallows' Eve, this year he will also have to contend with a werewolf, an escaped mental patient, and an evil unknown presence abducting town folk. Richie Hartman sorts out two of the three, explaining he only broke out of the mental institution to track down his roommate, the aforementioned werewolf. Thus, the only matter left is the missing citizens. At this time, it is revealed that Hubie was the last one to interact with each of them before they were taken, and the citizens of Salem live up to their legacy, and much like they accused his great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of being a witch in the 1600s, they are now accusing Hubie of foul play. Forced to run from the angry mob, Hubie takes shelter at the local radio station where he is recognized as their second most frequent caller, after the female who always calls to dedicate a song to her special someone. And just a few nights ago, while under the influence of Truth Serum, aka Chardonnay, revealed the identity of that special someone as none other than Hubie. With this revelation, there are only two possible suspects who could be responsible for the disappearances, and it's up to Hubie to determine who could be holding them captive before they take their affections for him too far and end up doing something unspeakable to those who have victimized Hubie his entire life.
I mean, yeah. How does that not sound like a fucking great movie to you? Oh, man.
Well, yeah, I mean, I punched it up.
Yeah. I will say this. This is going to be the first time and only time that I am going to take issue with one fact in your synopsis. Always so thorough. But I actually think there is an important conversation to be had about who does and doesn't like Hubie. I think that there is actually something really interesting there to kind of parse out, because while the joke is that everybody hates Hubie, right? Like that's the on paper joke. We discover throughout the film that there are levels at which some people treat Hubie, some people feel about Hubie, and there is a little bit of something all in between, right? I would put at one end of the spectrum his bullies, the guys that treat him the worst. Ray Liotta pushing him into a gravestone, that kind of shit, right?
Yeah.
At the other end of the spectrum would be somebody like his mom, just to give you an extreme in either direction, right? So his mom loves him so much that she goes on to endorse her love and call in every night to dedicate songs to him and shit like that, right? So there's this idea that there is a spectrum of people here that and the ways in which they feel about him. In between, it's not so easy to parse out. But I would actually put somebody like Kevin James's what's his name? Officer, you
Downey.
Just read it.
Officer Steve Downey.
Officer Downey.
Yeah.
I feel like Officer Downey, while he doesn't like Hubie, he's never cruel to Hubie in the way that other people are, right? So there's definitely a level there of which he is willing to deal with Hubie. And let's be honest, like Hubie is not an easy to deal with person sometimes, but he is willing to put up with a lot more from him than other people in this film, right? And then you get people that are a little bit on the other side of that, where you end up with a lot of the kids that we meet throughout this, especially the outsider kids. The more of an outsider a kid is, the more likely they are to kind of understand where Hubie's coming from in a lot of ways. And then, of course, we can't ignore Violet and the ways in which she feels about him, and she's much more closer to like somebody like Hubie's mom and the ways in which she cares about Hubie. So like there is actually a pretty wide spread of feelings towards him. It's just that the most expressed ones in this film are the ones where everybody hates him. And that's because that's where most of the humor comes from.
I'm gonna be honest with you, Siegem.
Mm-hmm.
I ruined this film for myself, this viewing, by doing the math. And when I realized that Hubert Dubois is 54 years old,
mm-hmm.
this movie really fell apart for me.
Why?
Because
why does that matter?
Because the level of like just meanness, evilness, like honestly, they use the term evil. which is where I want to discuss the face of evil, and that in all of these films that we've watched up to this point, like the evil acts that are committed against him. When I thought that maybe he's like in his 30s and a little misunderstood, the oldest possibly 40, like I could still get it. But this dude being 54 years old really was really just difficult for me to do the mental gymnastics to notice anything other than anybody who does not stand against the way that this man is treated is like part of the problem. That like the silence is sort of saying that it's okay. Cause like the only people who really stand up for him is Violet, and her whole thing with him borders on obsession. When you consider that she's been into him for 46 years, like
you're completely ignoring like the kids going after him in the cornfield, and like to the point where people are just like, "Really, you're gonna go take care of Hubie?" And this young girl is just like, "Yeah, fuck y'all, right?" And when that kid says like, "We should probably go stop him," right? That is the thing that makes her realize what a good kid he is because he says things like that, right? Then there's also the entire introduction to the fact that Hubie had a best friend growing up in Richie. And like Richie, even though he ends up in an insane asylum, is still like a pretty good dude by the end of this film. I mean, he breaks himself out to go save his friend Michael Walter, whatever we're gonna call him for the episode.
I like but Michael like, Walter. That works for
but,
me.
But like We are introduced to good people in this movie that do care about him. And as far as all of the terrible people in this movie, I will point out the fact to you that the entire concept of this film is that they are bullies and that they are shitty to him, to the point where there is a literal speech and comeuppance for them at the end of this movie.
Yes.
So, like, yes, you're not wrong. The way that people treat him is reprehensible, but it's not unaddressed.
I know. It's just it.
It's the plot of this film.
I know it's the plot of the film. I just read a thing. All I could focus on.
I couldn't watch that bully movie because there was just too much about teens bullying each other. Okay.
It's all I could focus on. I couldn't get past it. And I mean, it's my fault. I know that it's my fault. I know it's a hurdle that I put in front of myself and then I had difficulty clearing. But it was just like, the level of bullying, it just, when I put it into real world terms, I was unable to suspend my disbelief anymore. And then like, I know it's ridiculous. The words that are coming out of my mouth are absolutely ridiculous. But the reason why this film was so hard was primarily it is a film about 54-year-olds abusing another 54-year-old without consequence. Like, you talk about Officer Downey not hating Hubie, but also
without consequence. Ray Liotta gets some definite consequence in this movie.
This is the first consequence in his entire life. That's the end of the movie. And then by the end of the movie, I'm so worn down by the constant abuse. Like, it, the fact that Hubie doesn't break down, right, in the face of all of this persecution, he really is the greatest person in the world. Like, uh-huh. I'm sorry that it was just, it wasn't fun to watch. Like, the humor coming from that wasn't fun to watch. Him constantly rising above, like, good for you, but like, I want to punch these people in the face.
This unique ability to completely understand what a movie is trying to tell you and completely misread why it's trying to tell you that. I cannot tell you how many times you've talked about a movie and talked about them in terms that like, yep, that's what happens. And you're just so like, I understand this idea that like, it's okay. Here's the thing that really gets me about what you just said. Why would any of this, if it's not okay with you in general, why would it have been okay if he was 14 years younger? What does that say?
I mean, it's not because, yeah, that's an interesting.
I mean, like, it's the same shit that has happened to him in other films, right? Like, the ways in which he has been kind of, I mean, literally, like, if you look at him as being this genuinely heartfelt guy that is good and sweet and genuine and just gets shit on by anyone around him, that's Nikki. We've seen that already. It's Bobby Boucher.
It's Bobby
we've seen that already.
Yeah, it's...
like we've seen that in two other movies, and we talked about what a good time we had with them. So why is it suddenly that he's an old man that it's offending you?
So where it offends me, this is interesting. This is an interesting thing. Where I think it truly derives from is that in all of those films, he has a sidekick or he has a group of people who he is relying on. And while he definitely has a support system in Hubie Halloween, the majority of this film is him suffering alone. It's him against everything. Like, those kids going to help him when Freddie Mercury is going to scare him in the cornfield, that's a nice moment. But it's just a moment. And then in the end, he's the one who, like, takes care of them and makes sure that they're okay. So, like, I guess where it bothers me is
where
that...
Where is his support system in The Water Boy? That's what I want to talk about then. Like, what is his support system
The kicker. He has the kicker. He has the kicker and he has Vicky Valancourt. And Vicky Valancourt, as opposed to Violet Valentine... Like, Vicky Valancourt interacts with him in a realistic way.
Yeah.
Like, Violet Valentine is such a fucking cartoon character. It makes me uncomfortable.
Right? Like, even the bullying is cartoonish. Everything in this movie, and I think that leads into kind of the conversation about this being this holiday film, is over the top more than any of his other films that we have looked at. This is the most over the top film, and that includes Little Nicky, right? Like, there is a cartoonishness to this that I almost wonder if it was supposed to be a cartoon after his last holiday movie being one.
And if this were a cartoon, I think that a lot of it would have been easier to swallow.
That's also weird. That's also weird to me.
Well, because there's a statute of limitation as to when you're experiencing something in real life, it's harder to divorce yourself from it and suspend your disbelief. Where if this is an animated film, it's already animated, so I've divorced myself because it's not the same medium as I exist in every day. And then if it's able to transcend that medium of animation to make me feel real feelings in my world and my plane of existence, all the more power to it. And there is a moment in Hubie Halloween where, like, legitimately it gets me. Even though I've been having this hard time connecting with it, struggling to exist on the same plane as this thing, despite it walking and quacking like a duck, and I understanding what a duck is supposed to be, it still has that weird transcendence from the plane of reality it exists in into my plane of reality and gets me to shed a tear. I don't know. It's just, it doesn't come together well enough for me. I'm sorry. I have to admit it, but I think
That's fine. Saying the movie doesn't come together as well as some of these other films is a completely fair critique. Saying that you don't like the way that Adam Sandler's character is treated by other people in this movie is ridiculous to me, because we have seen him literally get killed by his brothers and Little Nicky. Like, he's treated insanely poorly by people throughout all of these movies. That is where his stories come from, is I'm going to take this guy who is genuinely in his heart trying to do the best that he can, but the world shits all over him. That is like, that is all of these movies.
So I think where the disconnect comes from then, specifically with this film, is that we never have the rules established as well as Nicky died. The first time Nicky gets to Earth, he is killed by a train. And we understand that the laws of life and death do not apply to this character. So even if he gets killed, it's just a minor setback for him. There's never that moment for Hubie. We never see the bounce back. Everything goes deeper down.
But I would argue that you just pointed out No, because if that were the case, Hubie would get worse throughout the film. The bounce back is Hubie's ability to overcome and continue on his duty. Like Hubie's whole superpower is he bounces back.
Yeah, I don't know. It's... I wish that I had your ability to simply view this as a holiday film. And
well, it's not, but it's not just that.
No, I know, like, it's not just that. I know it's not just
that. Are not holiday things. Those are Adam Sandler things. So what you're starting to do is kind of tear down kind of the points and reasons why people don't necessarily enjoy watching Adam Sandler movies, which is fine. It's just interesting to me that you sat through five other movies in which we watched Sandler literally get kicked to the nuts. He got thrown in front of a bus. He got like we see all of this stuff happen to Sandler where the world does everything in its power to put him down, but he's able to come back. And he does that. And like that is his every man overcoming the odds like story that we love so much. It's a rule of this universe. And that is everything that you're talking about is to me like, yep, like that's it. Like that's the story. So like, I mean, maybe this is it. Maybe this is just us like throwing the tiger on the table and like admitting why people don't like Adam Sandler movies.
I don't know. I really think that a big thing is, much like Happy Gilmore not working for me after I had analyzed Billy Madison and realized that they're essentially the same plot, is the same thing of that Hubie Halloween borrows from all these other plots and they've been done better in the past, in my opinion. And it just makes it difficult for me to experience it and enjoy it. I don't know. Because you're making a lot of strong arguments for, like, I don't know how you got in your own way with this, Devin. Like, kudos to you for pointing that out. But it does. This, something about this film, I can't jive with. I don't...
Yeah, this is not the pinnacle for me. Yeah. I don't want to make it sound like you need to like this one because you've liked other ones or anything like that. It's just that where we have talked about the idea with Sandler comedies in the past and the ways in which he uses things like physical shtick and the ways in which he uses the ways in which he uses his positionality as, I mean, let's be honest, part of the whole joy of watching him get shit on too in a lot of ways is the idea that we also know that he's a gabillionaire, like older white dude that like is willing to put himself in these kinds of positions. There's a little bit of that attitude to it too. There's so much behind the idea that also, I mean, there's also an interesting idea to me that like you're watching this movie and you're feeling so bad for this old man, but like you're ignoring the fact that like this was a movie that is like created by Sandler to put himself in these positions. There's like a weird element of just like, you feel so bad for this guy as if we're watching like Punked or something. Like, there's also that weird level to it, too, that like, is a much lower level argument for me, but also there, like, I can't ignore that. There's so many elements to this movie that are just retreads of older Sandler films, and if that's the issue, like, yeah, I'm with you 100%. I don't put as much weight on that as you do. But to say that the reason that you're upset with Hubie Halloween is because you feel like Hubie Dubois is too good of a character to be dealing with these situations, I guess I have to agree with you on that too. But that's the joke. Like that's the humor. And if you don't like that, I got news for you. I got five other movies you might not like so much.
All right. Not that I feel I have to defend myself, but I think I've found the defense for where I'm coming from with this. In every other film, we have an explanation why. And that explanation why sort of writes off any problems that I might have with the character. Because I'm told why the character is like that. Billy Madison is in the sense of arrested development because his father never gave him the chance to grow. Happy Gilmore is just working to get by because he's had to provide for his grandmother most of his life after losing his parents. Bobby Boucher is coddled and kept away from the world by his mother because of his father running off. Little Nicky, we don't find out till later on in the film, is a hybrid of good and evil. So where does he fit in this world? And then in Pixels, that one defeat that Bremmer faces in 1982 has made it so that he's afraid to ever try to succeed again, and led to his life of failure and being basically a loser. But it's not that he's a loser, it's just that he never tried. I personally cannot identify that moment in Hubie Halloween why everything is like this. It's just like, because he's Hubie Dubois, people don't like him.
I mean, I think there's a twofold answer to that for me. I think we're supposed to understand that his over-scarability, I don't know what the word is for that, but like the fact that he is a scaredy cat is, I think, the flaw. That's what we're talking about. What is Hubie's flaw that allows the world to treat him in this way? And I think because it's a Halloween movie, I think that the flaw is implied that he is easily frightened by things. And I think that to them, that's supposed to be enough. And that's not enough. I can definitely meet you there. Like, the idea that that's not a big enough flaw to justify the ways in which he's treated. Now, I think there's also some implications about the ways in which his mother raised him. And like, there is a couple of comments that are made about the way that his father treated him before his father passed away that, like, could also be implied what's going on there. But that is a much deeper read that is not necessarily there. Also, I might be kind of, like, pulling some stuff from the way that, like, Kathy Bates treats him in Waterboy into that idea. But there are comments and there are stories and there are things that we learn about the ways in which Hubie was brought up that don't help the matter. But I do think that what the flaw is supposed to be, the reason that he is the way that he is because it's the one thing about him is he is easily scared. And like I said, that's not enough to justify the ways in which he's treated. But to that point, the fact that people are bullies to him, like, let's focus on, like, one person to just make this argument a little bit smoother. The ways in which Ray Liotta's character treats Hubie, right? And we learn at the end is that he's always been kind of jealous of Hubie because he feels like he is stupid. But what he latches onto is the fact that Hubie is so easily scarable, and that's why he treats him the way that, like he uses that as a tool. Like, he gets his comeuppance for that, right? And he comes around and we learn that there's a deeper thing behind it. It's not just because Hubie is scarable. And we learn that everybody kind of has their own reason for, like, being jealous of Hubie and the way that he is. So it's not just one thing. So the majority of the movie rests its hat on this is the reason why he's treated this way, and that's not quite enough. And then by the time they give us kind of really more solid reasons why he's treated that way, it's too little too late. So, like I said, I can definitely meet you on that idea, that they don't give you nearly enough justification for the treatment of Hubie in this movie that they do in the other films.
Yeah. And I think if I had to really boil it down, right, is if there were just one moment, like, where he was a kid and he really boffed it, if he had his Chicken Little moment so that I understand why, like, the cops don't believe him. Because it's not like the stuff that he brings to the attention of the officer are completely off base. Like, he brings, like, there's that montage of him in all the different costumes. And the things that he's bringing forward, it's not like he's saying, Old Man Thomas is an alien. And we know that that could be the case because it exists in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. They're like, the stuff that he reports is all the type of stuff that you might need to look into.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. In a film full of montages, we are given this one in which he runs to the police for every little thing is supposed to be the attitude behind it. But I totally agree with you, to the point where I have a note about a later montage where they're showing all of the different scares as the credits roll. And my exact note is, you know, to be fair to Hubie, there's a few of these scares that would scare the shit out of me, too. So to hold him accountable for some of this stuff and say, oh, you just Hubie being Hubie, like, is not fair. It's not fair at all to this character.
And that's it. I think that's the thing. We never get that moment as to why he shouldn't be a credible witness. Yeah. And if that came, I think that it could really smooth out everything for me. But this film, as we've already stated, is specifically about being that fan service and just getting to the jokes that make you remember things about Adam Sandler and the nostalgia of Halloween and everything. So weirdly, as Adam Sandler has done more and more of these films, that nuance and subtlety that I really celebrate about the films prior to this is weirdly lost from where I'm viewing.
It's completely gone. There is no nice subtlety to this. You know, it's funny. We talked about the Steve Brill trilogy, right? And it's interesting to me because Happy Gilmore has such a beautiful setup for that story and for why Happy is the way that he is. We get an entire video montage with, you know, and with fucking Leonard Skinner playing over it, and we learn this whole thing about why he cares so much about his grandmother and why he is so angry at the world, and like it is this amazing thing that happens at the beginning. And then you look at something like Little Nicky, where he's a little off and he's a little weird, and that's funny, but we need a reason eventually. And so 30 minutes to the end, we finally are given a reason why Nicky is the way that he is. And then we get to Hubie and it's just gone. So it's like it's slowly been kind of melting out of the story until we got to this.
Yeah. And it, I don't know, and it makes me sad. I think that's the big thing, is that watching this film along with those others, it just kind of hits me as sad. So yeah, let's make ourselves happy with a little patented thing we do at the ASCU podcast called Something New, Something Old, Something Borrowed, Something Blue. I'm excited.
Yeah, man.
I'm excited. Yeah, wait,
so you introduced it, so you get to go first.
So I don't want to be this guy, but this is the first time that Kenan Thompson has ever been in a film with Adam Sandler. And when you consider that he's been on SNL pretty much since Adam Sandler left SNL, that's kind of impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, the first time that we saw Kenan Thompson in these films, for sure.
Yeah. And I imagine, based on just how good he is in this, that Kenan Thompson will be offered a place in any Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe film specifically, but maybe any film going forward. I'd really like to see them paired up in some way.
Yeah, I mean, even if he is just, you know, one of the, like, lesser used characters in the gang or something like that, right? He should get like a Jon Stewart and Big Daddy style role where he's like integral to the plot, but only shows up for two scenes.
I'm thinking in my head, That's My Boy Too, where Adam Sandler is his father.
There you go. So at first I was like, oh, Holiday, like the idea that this is the first Holiday film that we've looked at is kind of interesting. But actually, he doesn't focus on holidays too much, other than the ones that are specifically geared to holidays, right? So the other one that I wanted to point to, though, is that a lot of what you see happen in kind of specifically in the Netflix movies, and maybe there's something to be said about the ways in which once he kind of gets much more creative control over his films, because like, let's not deny the fact that the last movie we watched was Pixels, and that was directed by Chris Columbus, and like openly talked about the fact that it felt like there was a lot of heavy-handedness from other people besides Sandler in that movie. And so there's a lot more going on in these movies, and maybe that's where we're losing some of the kind of the edge, because one of the things that I didn't necessarily love in this movie, but we see a ton of, and it's throughout the Netflix movies, is running gags. Things that start like from moment one and then like keep showing up to the point where you get like straight up like cutaway jokes to running gags, like and specifically I point out like mom's t-shirts, the nickname that gets said once and then we have to hear it for the rest of the movie, the bike scenes. Every time he gets on a bike, we get a montage of him driving down the street and shit getting thrown at him. And like one of those would be fine, but the fact that there's like 3, 4, 5 of those running jokes in this movie, it does start to get a little heavy-handed in some of that stuff.
The one that really bothered me to the point of writing it down is the usage of the term boner to mean a mistake. Like, I know that. I know. I watched Growing Pains, and Mike Seaver's best friend was named Boner because he made a lot of mistakes. maybe that's not why Growing Pains. I think it was something getting past the radar. But, like, and then the continual usage of it, and nobody, and it's, like, contextual. He's obviously not talking about an erection. He's using it in that original colloquial way. But then when, like, Ray Liotta's mother is like, why he talk about his penis? And it's like, she'd probably get it. Because also, I think Ray Liotta's, like, mother is best friends with Hubie's mother? Like, I'm not 100% certain.
So then why would Hubie's mother not be at the funeral?
I know. That funeral comes out of nowhere. That funeral feels like we want to push Hubie Dubois into an open gravesite. Okay, let's do it. Funeral on Halloween. Michael Chiklis is available.
I think that the reason that that joke might work for me is because it really is just him that kind of makes that mistake going forward. Like, it'd be different if everybody started, like, so compare that to the Pubie joke, right? Where one person says it in a kind of small group at one point, and then suddenly the whole town sees it. And, like, to their credit, they even call it out themselves when he says, "Oh, that's spread like warm peanut butter." Like, that made me laugh. The reaction to it made me laugh, but not every time somebody called him that.
The one that makes me laugh is when Michael Chiklis calls him Booby. And yeah. I'm like, that's funny, because everybody else is calling him Pubie, and DePriest got it wrong. funny to me.
But see, there's some one-off jokes that are just fucking hilarious. Like, you mentioned the funeral scene, and the first thought in my head is after he gets pushed into the grave, and then Ray Liotta's mother is, like, yelling at him, like, "Why did you do that?" And he's just like, "Because he's an asshole, Ma." And then you hear the kid, what is his name?
Karen Bear.
That's the actor, right?
Yeah.
Karen Bear?
His name is ridiculous in this movie.
Yeah, but he he tries to explain to her, like, "No, it's funny. He wants to be in the hole. He wants to be in the hole." It was just like, I don't know why, but that made me laugh so bad. Oh man, shit. Yeah. But the running gags that you see in this, and then like the other movie that has a bit of this that kind of got me was Ridiculous Six and. The Do-Over? What's the one that he does with... Is that the one with Spade and him?
Yeah, that's the Do-Over.
So there's like... The idea of a running gag in a comedy is not weird. We've seen it in other ones. But this movie just amps them up to the point where that becomes the joke for like 10 minutes is just rambling off just payoffs to these running gags.
Yeah, they happen so frequently that you become inoculated to them. There's no way they could possibly be funny anymore. And I can't think of any of them where they then go that extra mile to get back to funny. They all kind of end right at, this is no longer funny to you.
Yeah. I think the attempt to pull them around is that they don't ignore them. Like, when they do happen, people comment on them. Like I said, like when he reacts to the random woman calling him Pubie, and he's just like, "Well, that's not great that everybody seems to know that." Can I be the asshole on old? I'm going to go first, and please, I'm going to take the obvious answer here, but like everyone and everything in this movie, like this movie rests on its laurels, knowing that like if you've come to this, you probably enjoyed Adam Sandler's other films.
Oh, Seijin. That's like, you literally took everyone and everything. What am I supposed to comment on as an old that he's brought to the table?
If you've got a specific, I am there for it and we could talk about it. But like the old for me, I just the entire time I was like, oh, this or that or this or that or this or them or maybe that or them. And they're like, so like. I could not settle on just one because everything in this movie is referring to some reference of a movie within a movie for this.
All right. So just specifics, because you're not wrong. I mean, like, my old is just a list of names, sort of in order of the importance to the Sandliverse. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start with Ben Stiller is the biggest old and the most important old of all of them, because it's not just bringing Ben Stiller back into the fold of an Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe film. It is bringing him back to specifically play a character that he originated 14 years earlier, no, 24 years earlier, Jesus, 24 years earlier in Happy Gilmore. Yeah, the fact that he is playing Hal, that's huge. That's a huge deal.
I think you're totally right, and I'm not. This is not me like negating or disagreeing with that at all. But I cannot let this go without pointing out that because we've talked about Steve Brill and the idea that Little Nicky and Happy Gilmore and Hubie all feel super connected, the other one that is in that exact same conversation is George Wallace as the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's also the mayor in Little Nicky. And I pointed out in that episode how much I enjoyed his moment in the church in that movie. And his scenes in this one are even better. Now, he is playing technically two different mayors. It's not as clear-cut as Hal playing the same, because we do get two different names for the two different mayors in both movies. But the fact that he is basically referred to as just mayor in both of them, and it is him just being this politician that is ignoring the masses. And he is just, it's not even like the mayor in Jaws. It's not like there is kind of that element in this where he's like, we have to keep it going for the money. But like,
we have to keep it going for the money. It's 11:30 at night. We've made the money.
Yeah, the money.
I'm just
the money
saying, like, maybe we don't have the fireworks. And you know what that does?
We
that saves us money.
Exactly.
We make more money by not shooting off fireworks tonight.
Yeah. But yeah, so in that same world of like the specifically like Steve Brill working with Sandler to connect these universes, like Ben Stiller is definitely tops for that. But I want to make sure that we do not leave out the fact that George Wallace is both amazing in this movie and also a callback to another mayor.
Yeah. Along that same line, this is the first time Julie Bowen comes back into the fold. And considering the fact that this is not a romantic comedy Sandler film, it's interesting to see her play the leading lady romantic interest again, because so much of that is so far, like, we haven't really gotten to dig our teeth into it, removed and relegated to its own type of Adam Sandler film.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to have them pair up again. And then also Steve Buscemi, because him showing up is what truly launched 1,000 articles, the face that launched 1,000 articles, because nobody seemed to understand why Steve Buscemi was in Hubie Halloween, as if they didn't become best friends on the set of Airheads.
Yeah.
And then him show up in an uncredited cameo in Billy Madison, like, as sort of the deus machina of the whole film.
And outside of our little universe that we've created, show up in now 4 Hotel Transylvania films with him.
and 5 films as a werewolf. Like, like right here, Hubie's pretty much my through affair to bringing Hotel Transylvania into this mm-hmm. universe. So, like, there's some important stuff with Steve Buscemi coming back. But if I had to focus on one, the one important character who comes back is Dan Patrick. Because it makes sense for Dan Patrick to be in The Waterboy.
Mm-hmm.
It makes less sense for Dan Patrick to be in Pixels. And it makes no sense at all for Dan Patrick to be the elementary school principal in this callback movie. I'm surprised it's not Robert Schmeigel or The Revolting Blob. The fact that it's Dan Patrick, putting him in 3 of the 6 films that we looked into during the initial season of the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, like, that was a real moment for me.
Oh, man. Awesome. Yeah, but that's what I mean. Is when I said everyone and everything in this movie is such a weird, like, there's a little something in there for everybody. Even if you didn't love every Adam Sandler movie, say you just liked The Waterboy, like, that one's for you, right? Like, it's amazing.
To tie
also,
forward,
I mean,
oh, sorry.
No, I was gonna say working in the diner. We mentioned The Waterboy. What's his name?
Blake Nelson.
Hunter's dad. Blake Nelson comes back, right? Yeah.
Which, so good to see Blake Nelson again. Mm-hmm. And then also specifically in the realm of everything and everyone, the fact that one of the hell demons is a costume from one of the people scaring in the haunted house made me so happy. Like, that's cool. That means that hell definitely exists in this universe, because that guy's dressed like it.
Did you pick up Covair in this one?
Oh, of course. It's my favorite Alan Covair. Because he's black and white. I love Alec Covert in Black
Yeah,
and
he
White.
gets his face bitten off, and he gets to call his own son of a bitch.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's so, like, he had to have enjoyed that so much. There's and then the other, like, if you want to go truly to everything and everyone, the usage of Werewolves of London when Hubie finally gets to the radio station, when you consider that Adam Sandler covered that in the tribute album to Warren Zevon after his passing, Enjoy Every Sandwich, which is the name of that album. Great album. If you're a fan of Warren Zevon, like, the tribute on display on that is, it's one of my favorite albums that I own. I'm not gonna lie to you. And Sandler using Werewolves of London after recording it in tribute to him, you feel like there's a reason for that.
Yeah,
Like
no, I
if
mean there's so much good stuff in this
yeah.
one
I'm
in
all
terms
over
of the
it.
callbacks. So what are we on to now? Borrowed?
Now we're on Borrowed, and you can go again. Why not?
Okay, so this one's a real one. This one's an honest to goodness one. I have made it a point ever since like talking about Billy Madison to point out that Sandler clearly has a love of older films, and that's where older comedy specifically, and that's where like so much of this comes from, like his jokes and his style. It is so hard to watch this movie and not spend the entire time thinking about the old like Abbott and Costello meets movies, like meets the Mummy, meets Frankenstein type stuff. You know, that old black and white slapstick. This is the comedy duo that you know from all of these other things. You know the kind of comedy you're getting into. Legitimately, we're going to retell the same stories we've told before, the same jokes we've told before. Like, so to the idea, to the comment that the zeitgeist of this film feels just like retread nonsense. Like, I agree with you, but like we made a whole market out of those kinds of movies, specifically around Halloween, way, way back in old Hollywood. So I think that that is so much the point of Sandler making this film. And so to that, I think he is looking at like, you know, the old Abbott and Costello movies and the ways in which they would run into a monster and hilarity would ensue.
I love it. I mean, Adam Sandler meets the Wolfman. It works for me. And then I'm also happy because I was real nervous that you want to take my Borrowed and then I'd have to scramble for something.
What you got?
I mean, sort of the whole plot of this movie is Friday the 13th. But if Jason hadn't drowned and was just treated poorly everywhere, not just at Camp Crystal Lake.
I love it. Yeah, man. I mean, well, so yeah, the evil mom is definitely a horror movie trope, right? Like for sure. And Friday the 13th being one of the most obvious ones, you add to that the son that is a little bit different and the ways in which humans treat him, it's pure Friday the 13th, man. Yeah, I didn't even pick up on that. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, like, it really hit me at the end when I'm like, yeah, the mother is the killer, and everybody, spoilers for Friday the 13th. I mean, I think Scream ruined it for everybody before I did in 2021, but I'll still take some responsibility if need be.
You mean Scream that came out 20 years after Friday the 13th did?
Yeah, exactly. No, but like, you know, zeitgeist wise, whatever. It's just, I'm just saying. I really got that Friday the 13th of it. But then also, the horror that this borrows from is really impressive. Like, Christine gets a real focal point. The Wizard of Oz gets a real focal point. And then also, the mask, the pumpkin mask that his mother uses, is so Halloween 3 Season of the Witch. Which, if you're setting it in Salem, I feel like you're almost obligated to reference Season of the Witch, the weird third Halloween film.
Despite the fact that everyone would rather that you didn't reference that movie. Yeah,
I mean, it's swinging around the other way. A lot of people are understanding why it's so great. It's not just me anymore.
the song in that movie gets me all the time. The
The one that triggers the transformation into bugs or
No,
slime
they
or slimy bugs.
Well, you know, he's a oh, there's no witches in that movie, which is still one of my favorite jokes about that entire fucking movie. And so, man, yeah. So the horror movie stuff, right? Like I pointed this out when we talked about Hubie on the Say Report, but I'm gonna bring it back up here. I'm right there with you. Like the horror movie stuff that is on display in this movie is kind of some of the best stuff. And to the point where there are straight up scary ass scenes in this film. And the one that I still gets me is Tim Meadows and Maya Rudolph driving down the back road. And then that's the what do you call it? The scarecrow is just in the middle of the road. Yeah. And like everything in that moment from them pulling up the funny conversations that they kind of have between the two of them are so well balanced about how horrific the scene actually is that like it almost becomes extremely real because it feels like they're being like rude, mean and funny with each other just to kind of deal with how scary this moment is. And it becomes a legitimate like horror movie scene because like Tim Meadows walks up, disappears, then Maya Rudolph walks up and all that's left behind is his inhaler and his wig, and then she disappears. Like there's it is a beautifully constructed film in the middle of this movie that is legitimately scary.
I mean, when I'm yelling at the screen, don't get out of the car, Maya Rudolph.
You got me.
You triggered that part of my brain that happens during horror films. There we go. Which brings us to something blue. And I get to go first. I think that's only fair.
So yeah. So what's your blue, Dev?
My mood after doing the math that Hubie is 54 years old was quite blue. It really, like I had to pause and recalibrate when I'm like, this movie's a different movie when he's a 54-year-old man suffering these.
I don't understand.
I don't get it either. I'm just being honest. But then, if we want to talk about the real blue thing I want to focus on, it's also related to my mood, to a mood, but not this. I really think they thought that Birds of Prey was going to do better. With everybody dressing as Harley Quinn. That joke is hilarious.
Yeah.
It's just like, oh, I wish. I mean, I love Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn. I saw it 6 times in theaters. But that joke, it's so on point. Everything about that, right down to the fact that June Squibb is wearing a I Shaved My Balls for This t-shirt during that sequence in one of her 99 costume changes. It really works. So just the blue on display in all of the Harley Quinn outfits that are put on throughout this film will be my actual blue thing that I highlight. But I was pretty sad. and we can explore it later why him being 54 really dragged me down. But I guess it's because centrally this film is declaring it doesn't get better. People are assholes your whole life sometimes.
Until your mother threatens to
kill them, right?
Engulf them in flame, yeah.
Most mothers do that when you're 12. Yours waited a little bit.
I do want to their credit with the Harley Quinn stuff, I don't think the intention was Harley Quinn's going to be so popular that this is going to be the costume everybody wears. I think the joke is literally put on display when she says, gotta show my ex what he's missing out on. And like the idea that a number of women, two young girls decided to start doing the like scantily clad Harley Quinn outfit for not just Halloween, but also any costume party, Comic-Con, anything like that. Like that is something that happened in the world. Doesn't matter how good or bad that movie was. There was a latch onto that character as like a sex kitten character. And so like the comment on that and the fact that they use specifically that version of it makes it just even funnier because in a weird way, I don't think any of those women actually saw the Harley Quinn movie. I don't think the intention is to believe that they saw that movie and thought, I want to wear that costume. I think the intention was legitimately just, I went to the costume shop and I went for the sexiest thing that was on the shelf. And that just happened to stand out to me.
Yeah, I know. I think that's what makes me sad. I just wish that Birds of Prey had been better received.
There it is. Yeah.
Taylor Johnson, the on the scene, Adam Sandler's wife, right? Like, let's just rip the Band-Aid off. She says that you want to show off to your ex how good you look. So that dude dressed as Hagar the Horrible, like the Viking guy, like they're just together taking the daughter trick-or-treating and she's flaunting it? Like, it seems like a weird plot hole in this film where I've ignored most of the plot holes.
Come on to Mormon country, man. There, the repression makes some weird things happen.
I will take your word for it.
When I tell you that Halloween is big out here, I grew up around Salem and thought they do Halloween right. And then I moved to Utah. Halloween starts in August and goes straight through November. And it's a thing around here. I openly admit to people that it has to be because Mormonism runs so deep here that they are repressed the other 8 months of the year that they feel they need to celebrate the scary one for 4 months. But beyond that, so the blue for me, and we talked a little bit about this, but now maybe is the time to dive into this a little bit deeper. But I'm right with you on the idea that Violet Valentine is just a straight up Mary Sue in this movie. Like the blue for me, the thing that stands out as kind of the squishiest thing, right, has to be her entire the quote unquote comedy that comes from her just unabashed just obsession with Hubie.
Yeah.
I mean, like, there's the only excuse for it is that there's no depth anywhere in this film, but that's not an excuse. That's just a reason, you know?
I mean, especially where we talk about strong female leads being like almost a requirement to be an Adam Sandler cinematic universe film. For her to be, like, at the same time, I wouldn't say that she's not strong, right? Like,
no.
She's weathered a divorce. She's raising three foster children.
Yep.
She's making her way as a waitress, right? Which,
you
like,
know that
you know,
she's working like third shifts at this job. Like, she's not just like showing up in the morning and home when the kids get home.
I mean, I was gonna say Reservoir Dogs and Steve Buscemi. He put it best. But yeah, it's just like she's a strong character, and then that whole way that she treats him is unpleasant, and it makes me sad.
Yeah, I mean, there's never a moment where it here's the thing, is I think it is not as bad as some of the other blue things that we have pointed out in other Sandler films, right? And I think that if there was something more in this movie, maybe we wouldn't even be looking at this. It's a testament to the fact that the rest of this film does not go blue in any real way. Like the grossest thing that happens is in like the first like 2 minutes he pukes on the road when he eats the raw egg, right? Like that's and even that's not necessarily what I would call blue humor, and it also only happens for like 2 seconds and it's never referenced again. You know, if he puked constantly throughout, we might be having a different conversation. But like so that's what I so like I want to make sure that that's on the table. Is that this is kind of the only real thing that I could have hung my hat on with this. And it is a little weird, but as you're pointing out, there's all these other elements about her that, like, at the end of the day, if you removed Hubie from her story, her life would go on. She would still be this powerful character raising these kids and living this life. It's not like at any moment she's in danger of the one being killed or anything like that, right? Like, so it's... It was weird for me because I was like, this really is the most offensive thing in the movie to me. But even then, I do want to make it clear that I didn't find it as offensive as some of the other stuff that we've talked about with his movies. He's gotten very family friendly, I guess, which is, sounds like it has more negative connotation than I mean it.
I mean, the sanitization of Adam Sandler films, I was surprised when I saw that this was rated PG-13. Because I thought that we were past the PG-13 Adam Sandler film. And
I
even
think it's
then,
the scares.
Yeah.
I think it's because it's scurry.
Yeah. There's some language, some slight language as well. But yeah, you're not wrong. But it also speaks to the fact that stakes-wise, they try to introduce a lot of stakes through Violet Valentine and her three foster children. Right. And every time you think that something bad's going to happen there, it all just kind of works out, and you should have never felt any way about it. Which also speaks to that Mary Sue, we're all capable sort of thing, like in an unfortunately sanitized way.
For sure.
Right? Like those kids run into the mental patient, Richie Hartman, and he just tells them how to get home faster. And we know that, like, there's a reason why, but they're never in any danger. And that's interesting in a PG-13 horror comedy.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Like I said, there's definitely something gross there to be talked about, and I'm glad we're talking about it. But I want to be clear that I don't find it nearly as offensive as some of the other stuff that we've brought up.
Oh, yeah. What I thought you might do with your definition of blue is Ray Liotta hitting on China McBride. That's not
she. It happens for 2 seconds and she calls his ass out.
She calls
out.
His ass
I actually
right
thought
out.
That was pretty fucking good.
It's a great moment,
even the first
time
I saw it. Yeah. So like, again, gross that it happens, but like, it is completely acknowledged immediately. Unlike the stuff with Viola Valentine, that's never quite called out. I don't think anybody even comments on it being weird.
No, it's just like I sit here like this makes me uncomfortable. And, you know, maybe it's because of things that have happened in my life that
yeah,
I don't want to talk about on a podcast.
I compare it to like Little Nicky, where we had the whole Clint Howard thing. Like, that was my blue for that one, right?
Yeah,
and like,
yeah,
that is just like, to a point, like, it's just unacceptable, right? Whereas like, I don't feel great about seeing this powerful female comedian that I like so much, like fawning over a guy on screen. But outside of that, like, she does pretty damn all right for herself in this movie.
Yeah, he's her kryptonite, and that's an interesting thing to explore. I wouldn't mind if Hubie Halloween 2 were just the events of Hubie Halloween from the standpoint of Violet Valentine. Because she leaves for work very early before showing up at work. Something happened in there, and I need to know what.
So I want to talk about one particular thing from earlier, Dev, before we kind of get into some of the other, you know, meat and potatoes on this plate. But you mentioned that you took issue with one particular rule, and it was the antagonist rule being brought down to his level. Talk to me a little bit about that, and we're going to talk about why I think that plays out exactly in this movie.
Because his level isn't down. That's where it doesn't work in this film. So they're not being brought down to his level. The bullies in this film would need to be elevated to his level, and there's no fucking way that they're elevated to his level in this film. They all, like, the second he throws his split pea soup and puts out that match, they are right back to treating him like shit. They never raise to the same level as Hubie. And that's because, I mean, Hubie, for all intents and purposes, and I'm going to say this, and if we were the Beatles in the 60s, we'd get in a lot of trouble. Hubie Dubois is the Jesus Christ of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Okay. So, I think that maybe he would prefer the Moses of, but...
Right, he is a Jewish lad. But...
Moses wasn't even that great either.
I mean, Jesus was Jewish.
That's fair. But yeah, so definitely, like, if you're gonna go at it from that angle, then like, there's no argument to be had, right? Like, they Hubie is not low, so to say that he brings them down to his level is maybe not the right wording on it.
But then, my other thing would be, if by the end of it he had been able to elevate those people to his level, then I could still make the same argument, because the inverse of any law should also stand true for something to be definitive. And specifically in this film, it wouldn't be a question of dragging them down to his level, making somebody hoity-toity act like a blue-collar person. That would be that's very much what something like Happy Gilmore is. That's very much what something like, I mean, Eric Gordon in Billy Madison is reverts to being the same sort of goofball that Billy is in the end, right?
For sure, and that's where the rule came from when I created it. So like, let's do this. Like, let's parse out the rule a little bit more here, because I think that what Hubie has introduced is definitely a conversation to be had about the rule. But the reason that I think it still stands true is because of the nature of the rule when it was intended, right? We can be constitutionalists about this because we wrote the damn constitution on it, so we can talk about it, right? Idea being that the concept of the rule when I brought it up is that he removes any mask of class from these villains. These antagonists are in this position where they always try and show themselves to be in a more powerful position than him, for any particular reason, right? So for Eric, it's the fact that he sees himself as a classier dude and better at running business, right? For Shooter McGavin, he sees himself as a better golfer, right? For the brothers in Little Nicky, they see themselves as better devils. They should be the ones running hell because they'd be better at it, right? So it's that whole idea that he brings them down to his level isn't that he brings them down to his level in terms of, like, maturity, but in terms of just, like, he knocks them off of their pedestal. And as long as the antagonist gets shown the error of their ways at some point, like, they get knocked off their pedestal, they have come down from the mountain and they've realized their flaws and their issues, right? And so I think that still runs true in this movie. Now, it's interesting that you say that you feel that they don't learn anything by the end of this film, because, like, I don't know if I can disagree with you there. Maybe like I don't think we get enough after the fact, like the year later conversation. The only real person that we really see after that is Officer Downey. Is that his name?
Downey. Yep.
God, glad I finally got it. But Kevin James. But I never believed that he was that mean to Hubie to begin with. So there's really nothing in that moment that really contradicts anything or changes anything for me. So, like, all I really have to go off of is that moment when they're all tied up and they all start kind of apologizing and admitting that thing, that their faults, that thing in themselves that they compared to Hubie. And, like, because of that, like, I feel like this movie still holds to that rule.
And I like that. I get that. They admit their faults, thus taking themselves off of the personal pedestals that they put themselves upon to make themselves better than Hubie. Where Hubie Halloween becomes a difficult place for me to view that as something that exists is that, for all intent and purposes, Hubie is without flaw. And fault.
Yeah,
like, for sure. Even his fear is something that he is aware of, and always, in spite of it, he soldiers on.
Oh, yeah. I noted in the drive-in scene that he may not be, like, traditionally brave, but he is certainly courageous. Like, he realizes he is scared shitless of an event that's happening, but also realizes that it's his quote-unquote responsibility, argument to be made there, but he sees it as his responsibility to still soldier on, right? And so, for sure, he is definitely. And the only flaw that I could point to is the idea of him being a scaredy cat. And I think it's also important that we recognize that that's also something he has no control over. Like, that is a fear response. That is something that is innate in a human being. You can't just be more scared. like you can learn to be scared, I guess, and maybe that's what we should have seen. But, like, you can't really knock him for having this human nature.
You know what this movie would have benefited from? And again, we've talked about this lack of subtlety and all that. Are you familiar with the show Raising Hope? Do you know Raising Hope at all?
Yeah.
Okay. So the first Halloween episode of Raising Hope, it is revealed that the main character, Jimmy, hates Halloween because he was always scared by this clown person who was out in the world. And then it is revealed, when Jimmy is, like, in his mid-20s, that clown person was his father, because he would always run to his father for comfort after seeing the clown.
Yes, and, I do. I remember this now.
And that is why Garrett Dillahunt's character was willing to constantly scare his son every Halloween, was because it made him feel like he was still needed by his son to make him feel safe and secure. And, like, as a father, that was his paramount of being a father. If a scene like that occurred, right? Like, we're told that his father used to chase him around the yard with a tennis racket,
yeah.
But if we had been given, like, that Hubie is afraid because his father put that fear into him, and now that his father is gone, his only coping mechanism for that fear has gone along with him, like, that is the kind of explanation that I need for the character of Hubie Halloween. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And having this discussion about his only flaw really being that fear, if I could have an explanation, and it doesn't need to be a long explanation, it just needs to be a reasonable explanation as to why Hubie is so petrified and, like, susceptible to things frightening him, would really go a long way in making this film feel like the other ones that we've explored in this series. I'm sorry I just talked about Raising Hope. It's a good show, though. Siege?
Oops, sorry, muted myself for a second. Right. I didn't unmute myself. No, don't apologize for that. It was the fallback show after My Name is Earl ended. So I think this all kind of feeds into my kind of my final new rule for this. And I will admit, with what you've just been saying, how my new rule might kind of work a little bit against Hubie. I don't think it's going to negate it. I think it's just going to definitely feed into why you don't necessarily like Hubie so much. So I think the last kind of new rule that I want to bring to the table that I think looking back holds true is that Sandler's character always has to be the moral center for the story and the humor. Like, you need to have him be the guy that you're rooting for. And because of that, kind of good and evil are all based off of where he falls on that. Right. So you think back to Billy Madison where, yeah, like, we see him as the hero and we see him as a good guy, but, like, also we would have to step back and admit that he is a bit of an asshole, right? Like, that is who he is. But because Eric's a bigger asshole, that's okay. Or because other people are not such big assholes, they're actually seen as really good people in it, even though they may not even be the best. I think of the principal. Well, like, the principal is not nearly as big of a dick as Billy is throughout that movie. But he is also kind of like a weird dude. The ways in which he allows himself to be bribed and things like that is not great. So, like, he is the moral center of that story, right? So to apply that to Hubie, like, Hubie becomes kind of the moral, like, ground at which everybody else should be judged. And there isn't a person in this movie that you can really kind of put on a, like, on a better standing than Hubie. And because of that, everybody sucks. Because Hubie is so pure, the fact that he is the moral center and comedic center means that everybody else is just an asshole and there's nobody else to root for. Kind of going back to what you were saying earlier, is that there was no friend. There was nobody else he could depend on.
Yeah, I dig that. I can think of supporting efforts in this film. I don't love that the only people outside of his mother and Violet who treat him kindly are both categorized as mental patients. Like, Walter is so kind to him. It's sort of the first kindness that we see, but it's also wrapped up in this, like, something's off about this dude.
Yeah.
Like, you hear some noises from my house. Just ignore those, son. Like, all right, so this guy's being nice to him, but, like, it feels like he's being nice for ulterior motives. So, like, you don't buy it. You don't buy that kindness. I don't know.
No, he needed more people on his side.
Yeah.
I think the idea that Sandler's character always has to kind of be that thing that we judge all other characters in the movie off of, then nobody stands a chance in this movie. Because his character is so pure, and when it comes to the idea of the comedy, and none of it is supportive comedy for him, it's all mean comedy. I mean, it goes back to the same conversations we've had a million times about why we don't like things like The Office. Like, you know what I mean? Like when things get to be too mean, they're just not funny to us, right? And, like, so I can totally support the idea that with Hubie being the moral comedic center of this film, it just, the comedy doesn't work for you.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. Also, I wanted to talk about the aliens and pixels don't really get down to his level or get knocked off of a pedestal, but that's not really important here or there.
Brian Cox,
yeah, that
shown to be a sheep in wolf's clothing.
There is some humanity there. You're not wrong.
And
Fire Blaster revealed
to
be a cheater.
Antagonist. Right, damn, the actual antagonist, like, of that.
No,
movie
it works. It works with that too. And but that's, you know, you bring up a good point with his character is zero, right? And then based off of that on the Axis. Yeah, that's actually really interesting. Having to have him on as the zero point on a bar graph of comedy and humor and humor. Not humor.
And moral.
And like, moral. And yeah, morality. Moral. Yeah. Yeah, morality. Yeah, that is that actually really speaks to, I think, my issues with this film. Because everything else, there's explanation there. That I can get behind that. I can really get behind that. I don't really have a new law to add with this film. It made me look at the other things as to what it is. And it really strengthened for me the family one. That's with the whole Cameron Boyce thing at the end.
Well, then let's make a quick addendum then.
Yeah.
Because we should definitely talk about Cameron Boyce, and I want to give him his due for the time that we can. But like as a quick addendum to that rule, the idea that because he focuses so much on family, you pointed out that we have seen a sanitization of his comedy. And I think it comes so much from that idea that it is so much more about working with friends and family. And as he's gotten older, that has also meant his kids. Sadie Sandler shows up in this one, as we mentioned in other ones, that they show up all throughout Pixels and stuff like that. But like the sanitization of is a pretty solid like part two of that rule, of the idea that friends and family are hugely important, both within the story and behind the scenes. And because of that, his comedy has gotten much more tolerable, even though that's not really the word I want to use, but like
consumable. It's become consumable. More consumable.
There you go. Yeah. There you go.
He's not offending as much. I mean, you want to talk about a Sandler in this film, Jared Sandler, who has like just the one scene in Pixels, called Zac Efron, being like performing 2 to 3 songs on the soundtrack as the zombie band leader, like. I'm like, that guy's from Pixels. Oh God, we stumbled onto something with this whole thing, didn't we?
Yeah, but yes, highlighted at the end in the title card that comes up at mid credits for sure.
Like it really just proves how much family and not just blood relations, but the people that he works with, who he enjoys working with, that he would want to work with again, and. Really, I mean, the way that he highlights Cameron and what he meant to him, like, he really does care for these people. It's not just, oh, this person was easy to work with, I want to work with him again. Like, I think that there's a bit of his heart put into these people who are part of the Sandler gang and who get to experience and live in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
He has an EP list on this movie that is a mile long. And that's important because he is the kind of guy, he is the kind of rich that means he could have funded this entire thing on his own, especially with Netflix on the back end. But the fact that in that list are names like Alan Colvert, are names like Rob Schneider, like you see in the executive producing list, the people that he brings on in the ways in which he brings them on to do things like develop scripts and develop that all throughout his career. Is proof that he cares deeply about the people he works with, because they're not just collecting one paycheck and they're not just spending the 10 hours on a set with him for a couple of days to do a cameo. Like, they're showing up even when they're not on screen. You get the feeling that they were probably there. I mean, the moment that really hit home for me was the moment at the end when everybody's in the backyard. And I think about the fact that you had Sandler there, you had Schneider there, you had Steve Buscemi there, you had Kevin James there, and then you have Kenan Thompson there, why can't I think of the actor's name again? The kid playing Freddie Mercury.
Karen Bear.
Karen Bear. Like, you have these people that, like, clearly were, like, not inner circle for him, but definitely in the circle, right? Like, and so there's that moment for me really drove home that idea as well. That must have been a hell of a day to be on set with all of those people being in that moment.
I mean, just look at, this is also, here's another new that I was going to, that I was flirting with before I just stole Kenan Thompson from you. This is the first movie that we've watched that had bloopers during the credits. And you want to talk about just the love and wholeheartedness that is happening on set for one of these films. Like, it's all on display right in that. like 5 to 7 minutes of bloopers from this film. And I'm crying and I'm sorry.
No, I mean, this is a really good, like, I mean, I think, like, more than anything, this is a really good ending for season one of what we've done here.
Yeah.
Like, this is the heart and soul of what goes on. So even looking at movies like Hubie, that clearly Devin had problems with, and, like, I didn't, but, like, we've talked about movies in the past that, like, I didn't necessarily love diving into Nikki, and you did, and, like, and there's been stuff that we have stumbled upon in, like, realizing these movies are not perfect. What is it that still draws people like you and me to these films? And time and again we have come back to the idea that it's just, it feels like comforting, it feels like home, it feels like friends and family getting together, telling a bunch of jokes, some of them bawdy, some of them not, some of them ones you remember, some of the ones you forget instantly, but the entire time you feel comfortable, right? And that's, and this movie was that. And so, you know, all of the biases added on top of that for me, right, is like you get all of that good stuff we've been talking about this whole season on Adam Sandler's cinematic universe. You get the fact that it is a holiday movie. You get the fact that, like, there's, like, some creepy comedy going on. And I do love me some dark humor. And I don't mean, like, dark humor and, like let's tell a bunch of, like, gross racist jokes. I mean, like, you give me a good horror comedy, like you give me Shaun of the Dead or World's End, and like I'm fucking in. Like that is my kind of horror movie, right? There's so much that is just like working for me in this movie, and that just speaks to the kind of movies that he makes. That it's why he keeps making these movies and why he keeps succeeding, despite the fact that normal measures of success need not apply.
I think that's the biggest thing, is that those normal measures of success really don't factor into it anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. this whole thing started when we watched Hubie Halloween last year, and you, 12 hours before we recorded, were like a kid on Christmas, excited to open up your presents, which was a discussion about not just Hubie Halloween, but the Sandlerverse.
Mm-hmm.
And it is nice to see that it is a gift that keeps on giving. Like, I don't know. I think the craziest thing is that watching Hubie Halloween made me want to go back and watch all these Adam Sandler films. And then in so doing it weirdly like lowered what Hubie Halloween meant to me. It's so strange. I don't think there's another actor whose body of work could have that effect on me.
Yeah.
And that really speaks to that different otherworldliness of Adam Sandler as his projects and his work relates to Hollywood as a whole. And I am very excited to see what other treasures and wonders we can unearth the next time we dive into the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Yeah. I just want to know what universe we do a Tim Meadows podcast in.
Oh man, I can do the research. Our universe right here, we're universe 6699. No, that's wrong. That's wrong. It's 9966. I will never get our universal distinction correct. There's,
I mean,
that's
why we're not
the law,
Steph.
Of the
all
ASU.
We can do, yeah. All we can do is overlook. We cannot travel because you keep getting the math wrong, and I don't want to lose a leg.
I mean, it's like sliders. It's like I keep putting in. I would never want to slide because I'd be like, yeah, let's go back home. It's 9966, and he'd be like, no, it's 6699. I'm like, really? I said it wrong again, but that was the one time I said it right. And then the gate doesn't squeak, and oh my god! All right, so. Is there anything else about Hubie Halloween that you want to say, or anything else about these last six movies that you want to get on the record before we put this one out there for the people?
No, I just want to sign off with my nice hair and sex hope.
You son of a bitch. You took my line. Sex hope was all I had left. Yeah, no, check them out. Check out these films. If you're just joining us now, you know, we got ones on Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Waterboy, Little Nicky, Pixels, and now Hubie Halloween. It's an interesting cinematic voyage. We hope that you join us for that. If you like this, where we talk specifically about Adam Sandler films, you'd probably also enjoy our other podcast, The Say Report, where we focus on everything. So if this, you know, interests you, go seek out The Say Report. It's on the same podcast apps that you found the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. If you would like to get in touch with me and tell me why I'm wrong for thinking that Hubie Halloween wasn't that great, I'm available directly on Twitter at Devin D. Decker.
And if you want to talk to me about how you know for a fact that June Squibb is a witch in this movie, and I agree with you, she's definitely a witch in this movie, you can find me at Siege Versus the World.
Dude, she just disappears and is never explained. June Squibb is definitely a witch in this film. And I can't believe we didn't focus more on it. And I can't help but feel a little bit responsible for that. But hey, we're going to talk about magic and heaven and hell going forward, because they're real in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe.
Mm-hmm.
And this film proves it. All right. So until next time, just remember, we have no idea what we're doing. Good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe at gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.